Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 112, I chat with Andrew Jones about his speaker designs for Pioneer. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded May 21st, 2012, episode 112, Good Speakers for Less. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. This week's guest geek is Andrew Jones, the chief speaker designer for Pioneer and TAD Labs, to talk about speaker design. Hey, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah, so nice to have you here. Those who are tuned into the live broadcast at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Andrew as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Andrew, let's start with a bit of your background. You and I share a common education. We both have a degree in physics, which I think is pretty important for loudspeaker design, isn't it?
It is. In fact, I got interested in audio at an early age and decided once I started my education and was interested specifically in speakers that physics would be the obvious thing to do. You know, I have a twin brother who's interested in electronics. And we both got started in hi-fi at the same time, you know, starting with electronics and then branching out into hi-fi. And for some reason, he kept the interest in the electronics and I morphed into speakers. And I've never worked out quite why speakers rather than anything else, but stuck with it. It's all I've ever been interested in doing.
Yeah. And now you guys could collaborate, actually. I mean, does he do audio electronics or something else?
Yes, he does. We both spent some time after my degree in physics. I did research actually in computer-aided crossover network design. And then I moved into research in active noise control, you know, anti-noise, getting rid of noise from ship's engines and standby generators in hospitals.
And he joined. Is that with producing sound that is out of phase with the sound you're trying to cancel?
Yes, the exact inverted sound. So you mix the speaker sound with the engine noise sound, and over some region of space, you get zero sound or, you know, a considerable reduction in it. Mm-hmm. He joined me in that group and ended up. His career has been mostly involved with that, doing headphone cancellation. So many of the headphone systems out there use techniques that he's developed. And at the same time, he's a great circuit designer. So he did some circuit designs for, if you know, Pink Triangle from England, the turntable manufacturer. He's designed their electronics, their preamplifier and power amplifier. Mm-hmm. And in fact, talking physics, that's where I met the founder of Pink Triangle. He was on the same physics course as me.
And, no kidding.
I guess that's where I first got to hear the first real hi-fi system. You know, I'd been interested in hi-fi. I'd been gradually building my own hi-fi with Thorin's turntable and SME pickup arm, Shure V15 cartridge.
Right.
But speakers, since I was building them, no great shakes in those days. lots of attempts, interesting attempts. Like, if you remember Jim Rogers, after doing the BBC monitors, he did a circular aluminum speaker enclosure, although given that it was in those days, I should still be calling it aluminium. So I tried rolling my own cabinet out from flat aluminum and rolling it into a tube. That was a big mistake. So that never really worked. I'm glad I have more sense these days. But I get to university, I'm talking to people on the course, and I might meet this guy, Arthur Kubasarian, and he's got this great hi-fi system. I go around, and it's Quad 33303 and the ESL57s. Mm. And I still remember the first album I listened to, which was Neil Diamond Taproot Manuscript. And that transfixed me. That was a revelation for me in what real sound could be, and started a lifelong interest in electrostatic speakers, which I still have on the side, let's say, to this day.
You don't really design electrostatics these days, right?
No. I play with them occasionally. I've got a collection. I've got Acoustat 1 plus 1s. I've got the BNW DM12. I've got ESL 57s and 63s. I've got all sorts of things. And I became great friends with Peter Walker and spent many an evening drinking whiskey and talking about electrostatic speakers.
But you did quite a bit of research, and then you moved on to actual product development with Kef and Infinity, and now Pioneer. And I know you had some interesting comments when we talked offline about the difference between research and product development.
Yes. In simple terms, I like to say, if I knew what I was doing, it wouldn't be research. Product development is you're supposed to know what you're doing so that you're not going up dead alleys when you're doing product development, because product development always involves a timeline where you've set your goals right at the outset and you've said it will need this time to develop. And although you can explore some avenues, you don't have complete freedom of exploration. You're on a deadline. Research is different. You're allowed to experiment and find out what really matters. And so my first, 3 years at KEF was just on the research side. I wasn't brought in to do product development. So that now allowed me to research things like how best to measure speakers. And that's been an important part of me ever since then, because I think, you know, when we get this debate about measurements versus listening, of course, listening matters. You don't design just from measurements. But measurements, the right kind of measurements, not even the right kind, but measurements done the right way. You know, there's when in physics, as you know, there's the difference between precision and accuracy.
Yes.
Precision is no good unless it's accurate, because precision just means you can measure this and get the same answer every time. Right. Accuracy means you're getting the right answer.
Right.
And I see so many times that measurements are giving the wrong answer. I can see the measurement artifacts. Because what's interesting about measurement techniques these days, they're available to everybody. Anyone with a PC and a $50 measurement microphone can make a measurement of the speaker. But since they don't know what it should be looking like, they get erroneous results.
Now, I will say that a $50 microphone is not going to be as accurate as a $5,000 microphone, right?
But it turns out it's more accurate than the measurements they're making.
Really?
I don't want to sound too facetious here, but, you know, it's astonishing how inaccurate some of the measurements that are being made are. And every single technique that is available for measuring these days at KEF was being done pre-1980. Mm. You know, KEF really did pioneer in those days impulse measurement for loudspeakers. And then, say, my 3 years were spent refining those techniques. And we were doing convolutions. We were recording music on a 12-bit processor and doing convolutions overnight. Would take 12 hours to process data, 1 minute's worth of music. But we could do inverse filtering and take out all the phase shift from the crossovers and all this kind of stuff and do these amazing experiments. So it taught me a lot. And so when I'm designing speakers these days, all of the early part of the design is based on measurement and obviously experience, but measurement. I will measure the parts. I will look at what I'm doing. And then when I've set myself a target and achieved that target, then I'll start listening. Because I know that listening to something that's early in the development is going to sound wrong. But I know
yes,
it's not right yet. It sounds tautological, but you know, that's the case.
Yeah,
I've surprised some people by almost turning into the show with something I only heard the afternoon before the show started. It's still prototype. You know, I kind of tell people I haven't finished this. I've still got to finish tuning it, but it gets you a lot of the way towards the final product if you know how to measure and what to measure.
And therein lies the rub, and I wanted to ask you about that. But first, I want to just mention that iPad 18877 in the chat room is asking this very question. When you design a speaker, do you design, then listen, then tweak? And I think your answer would probably be yes.
Design, then listen, then tweak. And the tweaking is always referring back to what my objective goal was and my measurement goal. So that I'm continually learning, because it's easy in any one environment to set a goal, be persuaded that that's the right goal, and miss something or miss something in the measurement. Oh, that looks a pretty decent measurement. I'm quite proud of myself. You go and listen and you go, it's not quite. But don't then assume you set the wrong goal or that the measurement was right, so why isn't it sounding right? You go back and you'll always find something that you could critique in what you accepted as you set your goal, you thought you'd reached it, but you look back and go, I didn't quite reach that goal that I'd set. So until you've properly reached that goal, you can't make any judgments as to whether the goal was the right one. And I went through this recently with working outside of my comfort zone on a project that wasn't a conventional speaker in a conventional room. My measurement techniques don't really apply quite that well in that room.
So what now, what type of speaker and what type of room was it?
Can't
discuss it. Okay, all right. You could tell me, but then you'd have to kill me. I understand.
That's right, yes. And then I'd have no customers and no blogs. So.
All right, fine. You were working on something in the future, and it was different than what you'd done before.
That's right. And so now my measurements weren't really fully relevant. Some aspects of them were, but not the goals that I would normally set myself. So now what would I do? Oh, well, I have to listen. And I have to the old way of listening and tweaking, which kind of got me a bit nervous. But, I think by now I do know how to listen. And so I could actually achieve good results. But now I would want to go back and go, okay, well, I can perform some measurements. I know how it now sounds. I know how it sounded before. What did I do from a measurement point of view? What relevance has what I did to what I measured? And start that learning process again.
And so go ahead.
But to tie again the objectivity to the, let's say, subjectivity of listening.
Yes. So it's not only in terms of objectivity and in terms of measuring, it's not only you have to know what to measure and how to measure it, but you have to also take into account the circumstances that you're measuring, that the type of speaker, the type of room you're in, and so on and so forth, which may change those other two factors.
Yes, it does. And to an extent, I'll probably touch on this a bit later, the music you're listening to.
Yes, and we're going to touch on that later, definitely.
Yeah, the target audience for that product. Because, I mean, I'm sure you know this, but the room is a critical factor in how a loudspeaker is going to sound. And part of this learning to tie in objective measurements, I hate to say objective versus subjective, as though there is no objectivity in any listening test and that all measurements are objective. They're not, for the simple fact that which measurements are you going to make? So a particular measurement can be very precise and accurate in terms of what you're trying to measure, but what relevance does it have?
Right.
And you know, the old days of you measure the on-axis frequency response in an anechoic chamber, and that's all you do. Or America had a scheme in those days, I think pioneered by AR, measuring a reverberant chamber. Neither approach was fully the correct approach.
Mm.
And I know Floyd did a lot of work on measuring at all kind of angles, taking compounds of angles and saying reflections in this direction have a certain influence and should the measured result should be such and such. And I'd done a lot of research when I was at KEF. I was part of the team that had something called the Eureka Project. And this is where we tied in with the Technical University in Copenhagen and with Bang & Olufsen. And we set up in Europe's largest chamber at the university in Denmark.
Is that an anechoic chamber?
Yeah, huge anechoic chamber. And we set up 32 concentric drivers. They were before we'd even started at KEF doing UniQ, I'd built all these 5-inch concentric driver speakers in spherical enclosures, driven by a 32-channel DSP, custom-built by ourselves. And we developed a program where for any speaker location, in any room, and any dialed-in speaker directivity, we could calculate the strength of all the reflections coming in from which direction. Then we'd set up these speakers in a sphere, something like 3-meter radius sphere around the listener, hidden by curtains. And we'd group all similar reflections together and play them through the particular speakers. And we could turn this anechoic chamber into a room, any room. You know, you'd listen to it with all these speakers turned off, and it sounded like an anechoic chamber. I promise you, don't ever bother to listen to a stereo system in an anechoic chamber.
It's a weird feeling. Anybody who's ever been in an anechoic chamber knows it's a very strange feeling to be in a room that has no reflections, no echoes, no reverberation at all.
It's sensory deprivation, and you're stood on this bouncing floor, and then, if like me, you take guesses and then turn out the lights, you really see.
Yikes.
Once we turned on these speakers, you got a sense of being in a room. And so we could explore the limitations of speakers in rooms. What if we impose such and such directivity? What if we remove the floor? Or the ceiling, or a sidewall. Mm. And so a lot of work was published from that, and it was the precursor to what Floyd did at NRC. You know, Floyd...
We're talking about Floyd Toole here, by the way. I just want to make sure everybody understands that. Who's been a guest on the show in the past.
Right, yes. And he was responsible for bringing me over here to the States. So,
excellent.
It was interesting experiments, and it makes you realize that a speaker, unlike electronics, which is one input, one output, essentially, speakers are multidimensional. It's one input and three-dimensional output. Mm. So you've got to take care of what it's doing in three dimensions and then how it's interacting with the room and put it into different rooms. They sound different. And we kind of know why, and it's what can we do to minimize that? Which I really like doing concentric drivers with controlled directivity. It gives me a sense of freedom and control that multi-driver arrays don't always have.
Now, Titus in the chat room asks a related question. How does the shape of the speaker cone and the inverse square law of sound propagation, which you and I know very well, how is that taken into consideration? And you were mentioning here the concentric drivers, having basically two drivers, a tweeter mounted at the center of a mid-range, say, as an example of that, that might be a different dispersion pattern than speaker cones of different shapes.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I'd say that don't get tied in too much with the shape of the cone in terms of square law and propagation. Mm. Within certain limits, the shape of the cone only affects the very higher frequency dispersion of the drive unit. The size of the cone affects the low frequency and the transition from wide to narrow. But once you've got into that narrow region, then the shape of the cone starts to have an influence. And it's interesting. Your theory says a narrow speaker will, or a wide, a big speaker will start to become directional at quite a low frequency. And this is what leads towards why I use concentric drivers. So let's go through the argument. So it's like focusing a flashlight. Low frequencies is wide beam, high frequencies is narrow beam. The transition point depends on the size of the radiator. So a big drive unit will start to focus the sound from quite a low frequency, you know, let's say 500-600 hertz. An 8-inch driver from around 1,000 hertz. 6-inch from like 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 hertz.
Okay.
By the time we get to the crossover point, it's quite narrow. And the stiffer the cone, the narrower it theoretically should be, because all the cone is radiating in phase.
Mm-hmm.
Soft cones typically decouple the outer part of the cone at the higher frequencies, so only the center is moving. Mm. So you'd think it's just, you know, it's the size, the radiator becomes the size of the voice coil, the dust cap. But it's actually bounded by the fact that the cone acts as a waveguide. And so this, what would become a narrower, smaller radiator with wider dispersion is now restricted in its dispersion by the shape of the cone. That's actually good news in some respects, because it means if I put a tweeter on, normally a tweeter mounted flat on the surface of the baffle is going to be quite a wide radiator at the crossover point, whereas the bass driver is not. And since the size is typically 6 or 8 to 1, the tweeter doesn't start to become directional until, let's say, 8,000 hertz. So now we've got a problem. On axis, if I balance the two energies at crossover to be the same, they cannot be the same off axis. Because off axis, say off 90 degrees off to the side, at the crossover point, the bass driver's not radiating much energy out there, but the tweeter is. So we must, if we have it balanced flat on axis, we must have a discontinuity off axis. And that's just because of directional characteristics. On top of that,
there's nothing you can really do about that, I guess.
Yes, there is, actually.
Excellent.
But let's just say, on top of that, we've got the fact that they are spaced drivers. So in the vertical direction, in the crossover range, where they're both contributing to the sound, they're matched in phase, let's say, on axis, so they add up correctly. But as you stand up or sit down, you become different distances away from the two drivers. Stand up, you're closer to the tweeter than you are to the woofer. Mm. You get now a path length difference, a phase difference. They no longer sum together correctly, which is why you get all these dips and peaks as you stand up or sit down in front of a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And then audibly, the ear can sense height due to the shape of the pinna. Mm-hmm. So you become sensitive to the fact that there's two separate sound sources. So how do we start to fix that? Because like I said earlier about interaction with the room is an important contributor to the sound of the speaker. It's gathering up all the energy that the speaker's radiating and delivering it back to you at different times with different intensities, depending on the absorption characteristics of the room. So, yeah, a dead anechoic chamber, you only hear the direct sound. But ears don't like being in anechoic chambers, as we said. We want to hear some reflections. That sound makes music sound more natural. But those reflections have to have a resemblance to the direct sound. Otherwise, our brain takes in all this information and gets confused. And not only that, as you move towards the speaker or further away, the ratio between the direct sound and the reverberant sound changes. Mm. If the reverberant sound is not mimicking the direct sound, then you get a different idea of what the speaker sounds like up close than further away. So speaker directivity becomes critical. The first step is fix the directivity issues. We can't practically widen the directivity of a woofer other than using a small driver. Maybe we go for a 4-inch mid-range. Yeah, that would be one solution, to go to a three-way system. But if we're talking about two-way systems, we can't widen the directivity of the woofer. So we narrow the directivity of the tweeter to match that of the woofer.
Mm.
That's what a waveguide is. So you see speakers, I've started using waveguides when I joined Infinity, in fact, because no longer had UniQ, which imposes its own waveguide. The woofer becomes a waveguide for the tweeter and automatically matches the directivity.
Yeah.
And that's why one of the reasons why I like concentric drivers. If you can't put them concentric and you have to separate them, put the tweeter in a waveguide and design the shape of the waveguide to match the directivity of the woofer and the tweeter up to a certain frequency. And so if you do that and you measure horizontally off axis, you can't, if you do it right, you cannot detect the crossover point. There are no dips, no peaks. It just smoothly tailors off. Move vertically, of course, you'd start to see where the crossover point is. But horizontally, you can't. So that's a good point. And then the other thing that a waveguide does, I won't call it horn loading, because I reserve horn loading for talking about compression drivers, where you're going full on to get efficiency. But one of the ways in which a horn speaker achieves that efficiency is narrowing directivity and controlling directivity. So a well-designed horn can give very good control of directivity. And that's what a waveguide does. It's a short horn. It's not designed for efficiency. It's designed for directivity control. Match it to the woofer, and because of one of the aspects of a waveguide, which is, let's say, semi-horn loading, it improves efficiency at the low end of the working range of the tweeter, which is always a good thing, because tweeters have got lousy power handling, particularly in the region where there's most energy, in the 500 to 5K is the maximum energy range of music. Mm-hmm. So tweeters have a hard time. The lower you take them, the more they have to work. The waveguide loading gives you something free. We want to control the directivity, but the side benefit of the improvement in directivity is an improvement in the working efficiency at the low end of the tweeter range. Mm. So now we can trade that and say, okay, well, it's working more efficiently. I can take it down low in frequency. And now I can take it down to a point where the vertical interference effects as I stand up and sit down are not as critical. You'll still see them, but they kind of ameliorate a bit. Mm-hmm. So what I do when I'm designing non-concentric drivers is to always include some kind of waveguide on the tweeter. It also moves the tweeter backwards within the baffle, so it more aligns the voice coils. It doesn't give you perfect time alignment, because just aligning voice coils is not the correct way to get time alignment. And with a high, slow crossover, you can't get time alignment. But at least you're getting some extra degree of control of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And putting in that waveguide, the tweeter at the higher frequencies sees less of the baffle edge. So you don't get as much diffraction effect at the higher frequencies from the tweeter. So there's lots of things to be gained by putting a tweeter in a waveguide. Mm-hmm. So that's, if you're not doing full-on concentric but still limited to separated drivers, that's, for me, the way to go. And you'll see that even those entry-level Pioneer speakers, I do incorporate a waveguide for that reason.
Well, that leads perfectly into one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on the show, which is to talk about those entry-level Pioneer speakers that everybody, including myself, raves about in terms of the sound quality. And then when you see how much they are, how little they cost, it's a double wow, because you can assemble a full 5.1 system for well under $1,000. And it's really unheard of. So I wanted to ask you, how did you manage to achieve such high performance at such a low cost?
One answer is, I wish I knew, because I got to do it again.
Next year's model's coming out, yeah. Well, I guess you didn't do concentric drivers, but you obviously, as you've just been talking about, did waveguides on your tweeters in order to match the directivity with that of the woofer. Most of them are two-way systems, right? The floor standers might be three-way, but...
Yes, they are. That's right. I've almost come full circle because when I became chief engineer at KEF, the very first product I worked on was our entry-level speaker. And now, for this project, I'm doing entry-level. You're going from TAD at $80,000 down to, you know, around the $100 region.
It's
nearly a 1,000-to-1 ratio. It's incredible. But it was a challenge. When we set ourselves the objective of doing this, I looked around. You always do a... particularly with speakers at this price point, you do a competitive analysis of what's out there on the marketplace. Right. You know, a TAD type speaker, you know your competition, but you're not so much going, well, this has got that and this has got that, so ours have to have those same feature sets. At that end of the market, really, it's driven by your own engineering ideas. And I'm going to do it this way. It doesn't matter what anyone else is doing. This is my way. With an entry level, you don't have quite the freedoms to be different, because different means cost money. But also feature sets are important. So you do a competitive analysis. And what I found was that a lot of stuff out there is designed to meet a price point and a cosmetic look, and that's about it. And you get it in and evaluate it, and it's very disappointing about the sound. And I thought, that's not what I want to do, because obviously I care about sound. It's all I've ever done. I like to say either I'm very experienced or very boring. maybe I hope both. But I want to get the best sound that I can at anything I'm working on. And how do I do that? Can I do that at those kind of price points? And I had in my mind that wouldn't it be fun if it could be good enough that it could be auditioned as a product, regardless of, oh, this is a cheap speaker, but just this is a good speaker. But how am I going to do that? Well, working at those price points, you've got to optimize every single aspect of the design. It's not about what money can I spend. It's about what money can't I spend.
Right. And
there's a lot of things within the speaker that cost you nothing from a production point of view to do. It might cost you time in development. Yeah, experimenting with cone profiles. Yeah, we had that question earlier. What influence does cone profile have in with the far field?
Right.
Not so much, but it does influence the behavior of the cone. So you've got cone material, you can play around with that. It's polypropylene. You can put different fillers in polypropylene at different levels to control the characteristics of the polypropylene. You can change the shape of the cone. You can change how you attach the dust cap. You can change the shape of the surround, the roll surround and the material of that. You play around with what's the optimum size of coil. You know, say you want to give an excursion, you could do that with, let's for example say, a 6mm top plate on a magnet and a 12mm coil, or a 4mm top plate and an 8mm coil. They both give the same initial linear excursion, but the maximum excursion is different.
Mm.
The mass of the coil is different. That changes the top-end response of the driver. All these factors don't enormously affect the final cost, but they can influence the performance. Just think simple things like, well, what magnet size do I use? There's maybe a correct magnet size, but you find that, well, that wasn't the standard size that the manufacturer uses. So if I want that size, I've got to tool it. That'll cost me tooling money. It's a part that's not normally manufactured, so the manufacturing cost is higher.
Right.
I might find that a bigger magnet costs me less. So now, if that bigger magnet produces too much flux, can I throw some of it away and still be better off? These are the kind of things you go through when you're designing a speaker like that. And even things that don't influence the sound quality as such, but will influence cost. You look at cabinet size. Let's disregard cabinet size as part of the sound and look at a different reason why cabinet size matters. The bigger the cabinet, the fewer you're going to get in the shipping container. And so you might fine-tune cabinet size and packing dimensions so that they exactly fit in the container. There's no gaps. So that shaves another few pence off the cost of manufacturing. And it's
which when you're making a bunch of them, makes a difference.
When you're making a bunch, makes a difference. When you're trying to hit a price point and get as much sound performance for the money, you want to save it everywhere that you can where it doesn't influence sound but does influence cost.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the exercises you go through.
What about materials? There's one question in the chat room about neodymium magnets as opposed to other magnets and how that affects the sound quality, but it also probably affects the cost. And another question in the chat room is about using wood, as a cabinet material as opposed to something else, and how does that affect the sound and the cost?
Right. Well, let's deal with neodymium first. Up until the last few years, neodymium was the go-to material for tweeters, for example.
Mm-hmm.
For the size, you get a very strong magnetic field from them. You can saturate the pole pieces, which is good for flux modulation, a whole host of technical reasons. Not so good for power handling because it heats up quickly and loses strength more than a big ceramic. But you can mitigate that by the fact that you've made the tweeter more efficient, because all other things being equal, at least in a tweeter, more magnet is better. So you increase the efficiency of the tweeter so it doesn't need as much current flowing through the voice coil. That causes less voice coil heating, less dynamic compression, less flux, static flux modulation. So it does a lot of good for you. Until the last couple of years, when neodymium costs went through the roof.
Ooh, that's true, because it's a rare earth. It comes from China. The sources are drying up, and it's becoming extremely expensive.
Yes. So certain magnet sizes went up 7 times in cost.
Oh, my God.
So everybody's been moving away from neodymium, and I had to, for these speakers, just couldn't afford it. So I do the analysis and go, can I live without neodymium in this tweeter and still get the performance that I want? And I found, yes, I can. Now, there's still certain instances where the tweeter has to be small, a concentric driver, or surface mount speakers in cars. Those kind of things, they still have to be locked into using neodymium. Ceramic is not an alternative there. But in this particular case, my first samples were neodymium, but then we realized, okay, can I go to ceramic, save money, and put that back into other areas of the performance? And yes, I can. So that's one of the first things, let's say, I sacrificed. I went to a ceramic magnet.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of other materials...
The wood or other materials in the cabinet, for example.
Yeah, cabinet is one of those areas where, at this price point, you're not going to use real wood.
Right.
Either as a veneer or as a construction material. It's too expensive. It's not stable enough to make solid wood cabinets work. And I'm not talking about people building cabinets at home, one-offs.
Right.
The amount of testing and environmental considerations we have to go through when we're manufacturing a Pioneer speaker. And environmental, I don't just mean, am I green? It's, will it survive shipping? Will it survive in temperature and humidity cycling? All this kind of stuff. Engineered woods are the only way to go for a low-cost product. And they can be better than wood. We don't want the cabinet to make any sound. So if we designed it right, let's say, it wouldn't matter whether it's real wood or not. because if you can hear it, you've made the wrong engineering decisions. The right. cabinet should be inert. But we're talking about price points where that's practically impossible to do. So you do your best, but you're not going to totally eliminate the character of the cabinet. But you're going to apply as much engineering as you can to control that. So in this instance, we chose to use curved-sided cabinets made from laminated MDF. Curved cabinets are the current fashion. They have certain acoustic advantages.
Such as?
All of the things being equal, a curved panel in bending mode will be stronger than a flat panel, ignoring the fact that a lot of forces are not bending modes in cabinets, but all of the things being equal. All of the things being equal, a curved interior volume will slightly reduce some internal standing waves compared to parallel sides. It's small, but you might as well have it if you can.
A little bit helps,
but traditionally making curved cabinets has always been more expensive, but we were able to do that in this cabinet. The cheap way of doing a curved cabinet is what's called kerf cutting. If you can imagine taking a flat sheet of wood and sawing multiple cuts parallel all across the surface, almost all the way through but not quite, then you can imagine you can bend that. It becomes fully bendable and flexible. Then you fill all the gaps with glue and you roll it up and you've got a curved cabinet. That's how all cheap curved surfaces are done, especially for architectural work. But it's very inferior mechanically. Probably worse, actually, in a lot of cases than if you'd have just stuck with a flat-sided cabinet. So we chose to use RF techniques. Basically, take layers of MDF, glue them together into a flat panel, put them in a press between two curved aluminium plates, it's like a microwave oven, put an RF field across the plates, heat up all the glues, bend it, let the glue set, and then you've got a curved panel. And that gives a very strong panel. So we've been able to incorporate that. And that was one of my surprises. How am I going to make a speaker any good at this price point? I was able to do that. When you've got a commitment to a buying volume because you're going to sell through a large box retailer like Best Buy and you partner with them to say, we're going to do this, then your manufacturing facility knows the scale of production. It has a timetable and you're able to get the prices that you couldn't otherwise get for all your components. You can buy in advance, you can buy in bulk, you know you're going to use them up. So you take advantage of that. So I was able to choose the right magnet sizes, the right cabinet materials. A real 1-inch soft dome treater was top of my list compared to what is normally incorporated at this price point. With the engineering put into the bass driver, it doesn't look that different from a regular bass driver, but it's attention to detail that gets you there. And then incorporating a real network. It's a 6-element network, film cap on the tweeter, air cord inductor on the tweeter, laminated steel core inductor on the woofer. Components that I'd use in, let's say, a real speaker.
but these are real speakers.
That's how it turned out. And, I don't want to sound boastful here, but I do surprise myself as to what I was able to achieve. And I'm not just saying that because, hey, Andrew Jones is supposed to be a good designer, you can do this. It's not. It's what I was able to incorporate into the design to allow me to get a good sound. Any engineer, given the right amount and flexibility, can do a good job. That was the key, being able to get that in order to start to do a good job. Having realized from the outset, hey, maybe we can do a good job. And so I was really happy with the way it turned out.
Well, as were so many other people in the industry, it's all very, very fascinating. Now, before we go on, and I have a lot of questions from the chat room, I'd like to get to some of them here before we run out of time. Mm-hmm. I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. Of course, Netflix, as most of you know who are listening to this podcast, knows that Netflix gives you access to thousands of TV shows and movies at instantaneously, virtually, through just about any device you have. TVs, Blu-ray players, game consoles, computers, dedicated streaming boxes like Roku and Boxy. I've just been playing with the Boxy box lately, and Netflix, of course, is there as it is on just about everything that you buy these days, and it will allow you to stream all of these TV shows and movies directly into your home, onto your big screen TV or your portable device. It also comes is available on iPhone and some Android phones, even some Windows phones. So you can watch it wherever you want, on any device you want. You can even start on one device and finish on another. So it offers you the ultimate in consuming entertainment conveniently. Now, for Twit listeners, there is a 30-day free trial, which you can get by going to netflix.com/twit. And please be sure to use that URL, netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. So, Andrew, I want to get to some of these questions here in the chat room. And
I would say one of the things about designing a product like this and being an engineer is that you can always do better afterwards. That's what I did. I'm actually doing better. Just a little teaser. I have completely been redesigning the range, going back to all the decisions I made before and going, wonder if I change this, what would happen?
How can I improve it?
And you know, that was the other exciting thing. Having done what I did, can I actually make it better? And so watch this space, because I've redone pretty much every part of the design, and I think the ones that are going to be coming out are going to be even better.
Wow. And when might we expect to see those? Will they be introduced, say, at Cedia or not till next CES?
I think it's around July, August time.
August time. Okay. Yeah. So we might see them at Cedia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, you're saying that they're going to be even better than the ones you've got now. Will they be significantly more expensive?
No. There's some small changes in cost because, you know, manufacturing costs have been going up all the time. So when I was faced with that, then I thought if there's going to be any price shift, even if it's only a small price shift, I have to definitely improve the performance. I don't want to just something go up and up in price. So that's why I went back and re-examined everything that I'd done before. So it's new tweeters, new magnets, new woofer cone materials, round shapes, vented pole pieces on the magnets. About the only thing that didn't change is the basic shape of the cabinet. Mm. But everything else has, and I think it's a very noticeable difference in the performance.
Now, I should say also, just very quickly, that to summarize these speakers, we have the SPBS21LR and SPBS41LR, which are both bookshelves, and SPFS51LR, which is a floor stander, SPC21 center channel, and the SW8 subwoofer. So you can put together an entire 5.1 or 7.1 or more speaker system from these particular models, and the new ones coming out later this year for surprisingly reasonable price, and expect to achieve quite significant performance there. I've heard them myself, and they are quite amazing.
Well, the fun thing is, you know, people come to me, friends, let's say, and they know I'm designing speakers, and do you think you could get me some of your speakers? And I go, you do know how much my normal speakers cost, don't you? You know, $80,000, $40,000. Oh, okay, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not.
At least now I can go, just go and Best Buy or online, you can buy some speakers that you can actually afford.
Yeah, really, exactly. One last question for me before I get to the chat room. I know that you also, as you've mentioned, you design speakers also for TAD Labs, which is, I think, it's fair to say Pioneer's high-end division, shall we say?
Yes, it's a high-end division. It's an independent design and manufacturing operation.
Right,
you know, Pioneer's
right.
The mothership.
Right.
But I design all of those speakers.
And those are, as you say, in the five-figure range. So we're at the total opposite end of the spectrum there. Does your work on those speakers, how does it or does it inform or influence your work on these entry-level speakers?
You know, I'm not going to say that these embody any of the technology as such. You know, my right. entry-level TAD speaker is $30,000.
Yeah.
But they embody me and what I know about speakers. You know, any project that you work on gives you experience in how to design.
Mm-hmm.
And the more freedoms that you have, the more chance you have to investigate different technologies and evaluate the merits. Speaker cone materials like beryllium, which I could have never got working anywhere else. And this is what I like people to realize. But why am I with Pioneer? Because I have access to stuff that typical high-end companies never can get. But it's when you start to investigate all those kind of things that you understand more about speakers. And the more you understand about speakers, the more you can apply that knowledge at any price point. And it's just as much a challenge. Designing a cost-no-object speaker, which never is cost-no-object, even at $80,000, yeah. you're meeting a price point.
Right.
But particularly at $100 or thereabouts, it's as much of an engineering challenge and as much satisfaction. I remember one blog that got started after I first released these speakers. Someone said, oh, that's just hype from Pioneer, that Andrew Jones, who designs TAD, is proud to have released these speakers. So I went on the blog and said, actually, this is me, and I am proud of doing it. You know, it's it's just as much exciting. And like I said, at least people, my friends can afford to buy it, so I can kind of boast to them.
Yeah, right, right. iPad 1887 asks a question. What is the most expensive speaker you've ever designed? Is it the $80,000 a pair TADs?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Very good.
In my mind, I've designed some even more expensive.
I'm thinking about the KEF. Were you at KEF or did you leave already by the time they did the Blade and the Muon?
No, I'd left. I left in 94. So the KEF reference 1, 2, 3, 4 were the last projects that I'd worked on there.
Mm.
But I'd left. Let's say some of the work I'd been doing in improving the concentric drivers, that got embodied in some of the later projects. But they've moved on significantly since then. So, mm-hmm. no, other than some of the technologies that KEF's still using, like their kind of carbon foam filling, I was working on that in my research mm-hmm. days. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to lay... play more credit to anything they're currently doing in that sense. They're doing a great job these days.
Oh, they really are. And those particular speakers, the Blade and the Muon, are definitely cost no object reference kind of design.
Well, I'd say Muon, yes. Blade, that's actually a good price for what they've done. So, yeah.
Okay. Inti in the chat room asks, and I was going to ask you this anyway, is there any difference in the way you design concentric drivers with KEF versus, say, the concentric drivers in Tannoy, which is also very famous for using concentric drivers?
They're all different. The general principle is the same, that it's concentric, and
yep.
the diaphragms are mostly aligned. The Tannoy was different in that the diaphragm is behind the cone, you know, behind the magnet. So there's a significant extra delay of the sound from the tweeter than there is from the bass / mid-range driver.
Mm.
KEF system, the acoustic centers were largely aligned. It's not the voice coils, but it's the acoustic centers of where the sound actually emanates from were largely aligned. But the interesting thing when I joined Pioneer and started working with the engineering teams in Tokyo is that Pioneer's history of concentric drivers is much, much longer than we were doing at KEF. 1954, our first concentric driver. Mid-70s, our first acoustically aligned concentric driver. Mm-hmm. Long, long history. So the difference between them, between KEF and Tanoi, was where the tweeter and voice coils originated with the design structure.
Mm-hmm.
The difference with what I'm doing with Pioneer and TAD is access to materials technology. Far right. outstrips anything I ever had access to before. Beryllium. Being able to do a beryllium cone, custom manufactured in our own facility, vapor deposition. Nobody else can manufacture a cone like that. It's not possible currently with foil. It's only vapor deposition. We're the only people doing vapor deposition. Nearly 15 years ago, Pioneer were making diamond tweeters.
I was going to ask you about diamond tweeters, if you've worked with those at all.
I haven't directly, but I've looked at it because, as I just said, Pioneer has a history of doing that. And ceramic graphite, all these different materials, we can evaluate the performance of each. Now, diamond, to be specific, you're looking for the stiffest, lightest material. It's the ratio of stiffness to weight that matters in terms of diaphragm performance. Mm. Look at the stiffness to weight ratio of diamond versus beryllium. Diamond is actually slightly better from a stiffness to weight ratio, but it's not as manufacturable. You can't create as complex shapes. It gets its stiffness to weight ratio by being both stiffer but heavier also than beryllium. So efficiency goes down. You can't also... So we get added efficiency by being able to a complex shape of a cone dome, not just a simple dome. We get added stiffness, which makes up for any slight differences. Let's go easy.
Right.
Differences between the material properties, and on top of that, we can make a mid-range cone. You couldn't possibly make a six-inch. No one else can make a six-inch beryllium cone. Never mind ever making a six-inch
diamond cone.
And if you could only, I used to say only the Queen could afford it, but right. Now it'd be J.K. Rowling's.
Yeah, right. Tefman in the chat room asks for comments on cabinet size versus port size versus frequency response. And I would add to that ported speakers versus sealed speakers.
Okay. So first, you and I being physicists, let's give the physics answer.
Yeah.
There's a strict relationship, and no matter what anyone tells you, you can't change the laws of physics.
You cannot change the laws of physics.
Box size, bandwidth, efficiency. They are tied together intimately. Choose any two, the third one is given to you. So if you want good efficiency and good bass, you have to have a big cabinet. No way around it. The only way around it is within that equation, there's an efficiency constant. And it's lowest for closed box, and it's higher for reflex. But what you trade is very low frequency response. So a closed box rolls off gradually, but starts from a high frequency. A reflex loudspeaker maintains a flatter response initially down to a lower frequency, but then rolls off more rapidly.
Mm. Well, there you go. Bruce S. in the chat room asks, so what are your thoughts on silver, oxygen-free copper, quote, magic speaker cables?
Let me preface this by... Look at my background first. Physicist, research engineer, KEF, and everybody that was associated with me at KEF, intimately involved with the guys at Quad. All these people, we didn't believe in any of this, as I would have said in those days, foo-foo magic stuff.
Right.
But I don't want to be disrespectful because I didn't believe in it those days. When I started this TAD project, 10 years ago now, I knew by doing an ultra high-end speaker, I would be in the marketplace where, let's say, either people believe it makes a difference and it's a critical component to what you're doing and how you present your system, or it actually does make a difference in the context of a system at that performance level. So I had to be the true meaning of a skeptic, which means open-minded. People think skeptic means closed-minded. It's right. The exact opposite. But open-minded enough to review what's happening. And although I don't have the measurements to back it up, another area where measurements maybe don't tell you everything or you don't know what measurements to make, I do believe these days that some of these factors make a difference. But it comes down to allocation of resources. Where is the money best spent? Mm. Now, in a low-cost system, spend it on regular engineering. In a high-end system, someone put it quite well, because myself as the engineer, if I look at the cost of incorporating, let's say, that example, oxygen-free monocrystal silver cable, right, or silver-plated with gold, as some cables are now, that's going to cost me a fortune to internally wire my speaker. Regardless of does it or does it not make some difference or a significant difference, it is a significant cost. Internally in my speaker, if I need to incorporate that cost for the cable compared to putting it into cone material technology or magnet or cabinet, I'm always going to spend my money towards the speaker component side of it. Outside of that, as a system, you as a customer are able to make your own evaluation of that. Where do you place the cost proportionally within the system? Are you going to spend $50,000 on cable and $10,000 on a speaker? No, just as much as you wouldn't spend $50,000 on a speaker and $2,000 on the amplification. You have to make a balance. And you have to decide from your listening where that balance should be. Is the sound of one cable versus another, for whatever it is or isn't, I'm not going to get into that argument as such, but does it make a difference that is not a different kind of sound difference to that of upgrading a speaker? So no matter how much you upgrade your speaker, you're on a losing curve because you're limited by a cable. If you feel you are, you need to change the cable. One guy put it very well. With a high-end system like TAD, if you like the TAD sound and you buy the best of what we've got, the best TAD speaker, the best of our electronics, then you've got nowhere else to go to improve the system. That's when you can spend as much as you want on cables, because you've finished balancing the system with respect to the electronics and the speakers. Now you can make your decision on the cables. But if you had a more entry-level TAD system, say entry-level means $30,000 speaker for us, then now you're into a value judgment about how much to spend on the cables rather than upgrading to the next higher-up speaker in the TAD line. And that's a more difficult judgment, and that's something I don't try and influence. That's down to the customer and the dealer to work out between themselves how they should spend that. I hope I'm not weaseling out of it.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's a very intelligent answer.
Of how to judge things.
Yes, exactly. One last question. Lawn Dog in the chat room asks, could you tell us some speaker models from the past that have the sound that you really like? You mentioned electrostatics earlier, and obviously you like the sound of those. Any other examples of speakers in the past that have impressed you?
Well, let me say, first of all, ESL 57, like we said, because I've always loved what electrostatics can do and hated what they can't. And particularly with these concentric drivers, with the Brillium has given me the capability for me of getting the detail and the resolution that I expect to hear from some electrostatics, not all, but with a dynamic capability, an extension, and just an overall power and reality of sound that an ESL57 can never do. It can never reproduce the scale of the music. It's too small, too limited. But within its limitations, it's good. So I always come back to that. I had a very special relationship with Peter Walker. I nearly went to work for Quad at one point. When he was retiring, I was going to understudy him. So I've got a special interest in electrostatics. The Beveridge was another one, as something totally off the wall, or on the wall, as you might say.
The Beveridge?
What was it called again?
What was it called again?
Beveridge. It was another physicist. It must be this physicist part of me. Yes. So, you know, let's say unusual designs. And then, you know, for regular stuff, the BBC LS35A was always, it wasn't perfect, it wasn't accurate, but it was always an interesting sound that you could sit down and go, I see why people like this.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of a fascinating hour, and I haven't even gotten to all the questions I wanted to ask you, much less those of the chat room. So will you come back sometime?
Absolutely. I love doing this. So it's been great fun. I'd love to come back.
Excellent. Thank you. Beatmaster in the chat room, I think, makes a very good point to close with, which is the setup is right when you stop comparing and start enjoying. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. Andrew Jones, the chief speaker designer at Pioneer and TAD Labs, for a fascinating hour of geeking out over speakers. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. You can read more about Andrew's work at TAD-labs.com, which is where the high-end stuff is. You can also go over to Pioneer, pioneerelectronics.com, to find these entry-level speakers, which we've been talking a lot about and which are impressing everyone in the industry. My online home, of course, is hometheater.com. You can also email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next Monday is Memorial Day, so of course the Twit studios will be closed so that we can all enjoy a Monday off. But that doesn't mean there won't be a Home Theater Geeks. We're going to record it tomorrow, Tuesday, May 22nd at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time, and it will be played at its regular time on Monday. But if you want to join me live, tune back in tomorrow at 4 p.m. for that special recording of Home Theater Geeks, where when my guest geek is scheduled to be Kevin Miller, an ISF calibrator who just finished producing a huge face-off of flat panels just this past weekend. And he's going to share with us the results of that face-off, which I'm really looking forward to checking out and hearing about what happened during that weekend. So I sure hope you'll join me. Until then, geek out.